You're listening to Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast Show with your hosts, Craig Bisgeier and Tim Harrison. We're bringing you the latest news, reviews, and interviews on the hobby of model railroading. The Model Railcast Show, keeping you on the right track.
Craig, it's good to be with you again, dude. It hasn't been as long as the last time.
That is true. Thank goodness for that.
Exactly.
Both full lives.
Exactly. All right, Model Railcasters, it's show 226, and we're happy to be back. We're going to be having we said he was going to be a disembodied voice, but we do have Mike Deverell with us. Mike, how you doing?
Good.
Excellent. And of course, one Craig Bisgeier. Craig, how's it going?
Not bad, thanks. You?
All right, doing okay. I'm just so happy. I'm so happy that it's not raining at the moment.
Yeah, it's been doing that a lot.
The kids started freaking out the other day. They're like, "What? There's a strange ball of fire in the sky. What's happening?"
Yeah, right. There you go. They start thinking, "How do we take these paper boots and like upscale them? Because we're gonna need them."
Exactly. So yeah, so it's just nice, nice to have nicer weather, get some stuff done outside, and been actually trying to scope out the barn room a little bit more. Trying to come up with
so
Craig, I'm dying to know what's happening with the Craig Bisgeier and the Housatonic Railroad, or
nothing, literally nothing. I've actually spent a lot of time in the last month since we last talked. I had some issues with the printer, and I'm in the process of still trying to get them fixed, and have been, you know, I don't want this to become the, you know, Craig talks about 3D printing all the time kind of thing. But no, really, I've just been having some issues. I actually started, I don't think I mentioned on the last show, maybe I did, I don't recall, but I actually started a new printer that I'm working on, and I finally got all the parts in for that. It's about 60% all built up now, maybe about 70%. And so that's been taking up a lot of time. And then railroad-wise, I haven't had much time to get downstairs. I've actually been out in the field a lot for work lately. I just got back this week from Windsor, Ontario. Lovely place. And so I was there for about a week. And I'll be home for a week, and then I'll be going back again for 2 weeks. So it's it's kind of difficult to get stuff done on the railroad when you're not here. But so hoping, though, to be getting some more stuff done soon. I have some more car projects planned and a few other things, so looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, here it's been, we've been trying to take advantage of the nicer weather to get some honeydew stuff.
Oh, tell me about it. I've been doing this thing.
And so, you know, it's all good, but I'm definitely looking forward to getting back to the planning thing, doing a little bit more research, you know, trying to figure out exactly what was going on in town in 1948, just trying to gather in the information gathering stage so far, and I know I mentioned it before, but I am fortunate that a lot of the guys who I keep saying a lot of the guys, a fair amount of the guys are internet savvy enough to have conversations with over Facebook or even email, who, you know, worked the line going through town, so can tell me a little bit about what was there. There was a guy, and I mentioned this on the show before, but it was a few years back, but his name was Eddie Fell, and he was an engineer for the PRSL, and he was a senior engineer, so one of his jobs was to help the younger guys qualify. And he, so what was cool was he just basically made the handwritten maps of the tracks of, and of course, as people are qualifying, not only does he have the tracks, but he has the mileposts, so he's got all the sidings drawn in. Just basically, you know, again, it's not to scale, but at least you have the milepost so you can roughly see how long something was. He'll mention how many 40-foot cars would fit.
That's invaluable. So, that's great stuff.
So, yeah, it really is. And so, and fortunately, somebody had the presence of mind to get that, to scan it, and put it online. So it's in the PR SL archive. So it's, you know, it's forever preserved, which is really cool. Yeah, and it's nice because it's like pretty much if it was a rail line. As far as I know, there wasn't anything that the PRSL did railroad-wise that he didn't draw a map of and had people qualify for. So the whole system, basically, he's got done. Yeah, so it's really cool.
Hey,
3, 2, 1.
Okay, for the Roundhouse, we've got Mike Devereaux on board, and Mike, I know you wanted to talk some 3D printing. I just, in our brief message, it sounds like you're looking into some really cool things, so I'm just going to go ahead and let you lead it off, if you like, but then at some point, if time permits, I would just love to ask you a few questions about what's going on with your model railroad and what you're doing.
Well, that sounds great. I listened to last month's, and first of all, I want to just express, when I first started listening to railroad podcasts, the very first podcast I ever listened to was Ryan Anderson.
There you go.
And, I probably caught him around episode 20 to 30, somewhere in there. And so for me, this is really kind of a privilege because I really did enjoy Ryan's interview. So,
he was great.
I loved Ryan. He was so much fun.
But last month's show, you got Craig was kind of talking about 3D printing, and I had gotten into it probably about 8 months ago. And the purpose that I got into it really was I wanted to make characters, people for my railroad, because the problem I have with a lot of the commercially available ones is that you're kind of stuck with the factory formed shapes. And the only way to really do that is to sit and spend hours, basically remodeling all these people. And I have, so I got I got an Ender 3, which is an extruded type printer. And then I'm not using this for making people, but it gave me a chance to practice and to learn these skills for what my ultimate goal was, is to get an SLA printer or a resin printer. Mm-hmm. And I've been playing around with something, Craig. I know you work in programming just a bit. And if you take a look, Adobe has one. There's a couple other companies that are out there. They're free. And they're for making video games. And the purpose of them is to create a person. So you build their body structure and everything, but they're kind of in this T-shaped. So, you got your legs, your arms setting out and everything else. Okay. And then the next step is you got to have a program that you can actually form them into a position that you want them in.
Okay.
And once you do that, you can get it into an STLA or an OBJ format.
Okay.
And now you can actually, slice that up and 3D print it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's where I'm kind of going with what I've been looking at 3D printing, because you could then in turn resin print, because resin gives you such great resolution. You can now create HO scale characters in the shape and form that you want.
See, that's cool. That's actually a neat idea.
It is. Now, for the downsides.
Of course, there's always downsides.
Well, right now, you can work, building characters and making the people shapes in those T forms is easy. There's plenty of software out there that's free or that you can play around with and do everything else. But most of the programs that we have are designed like they'll have a person in motion or something like that, where you want them to actually hold steel. They haven't gotten to the point of actually having a steel figure where you could actually shape them and then print that, or save that file as an OJ.
So you're saying they start off as an action pose and then it's difficult to move them into a standard standing pose.
Right, so that you could actually get them into the pose you want. Now, interestingly enough, one of the game companies, Ubisoft, I just was on their website not too long ago, and they are getting ready to release a program that would allow you to basically have that 3D shape and pose your character into a position that you want.
Okay.
And then in turn you would be able to print them up. So we're still working on this way, and my thought was to anybody who's out there in the field or something, let us know, because I think this is really a huge boost for the modeling hobby itself. Is now we could actually make you know, for instance, you're modeling in 1890. Well, you know, the dress is different.
Of course.
So to be able to put clothes on these people and do this entire thing and make them period correct is a huge plus. And that's why I was really excited when I started looking at the SLA printers.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, along those lines, I've never done exactly what you're talking about, but I have had a little of experience with the idea of skinning things. And what that means is a lot of things like back in the day, it's not that long ago, but there was like around the time when Doom came out, and I'm sure, you know, there have been other games like Battlefield and other things like that. There was a whole bunch of things where you could take an object that was there and you could skin it. Basically, it would be like you say a generic, like a tank, let's say, and you could take that and give the general dimensions of it in order to say, okay, well, this is about the size and shape, and then you could import photographs or paintings, you know, digital paintings of that object, and basically hang them or paint them onto that wireframe type of thing.
Exactly.
Right, and then basically that would then kind of become what you're talking about. You know, basically you'd be skinning an object, you know, putting a skin over it. And it sounds to me like what you're talking about is something very similar, where you'd have a basic human frame, okay, and then basically take, you know, scans or like that, or pictures, and be able to say, okay, well, this is the right side, this is the front side, this is the left side, and just hang those things on there, and then you basically have a picture of that person. Now, the hard part for 3D printing would be trying to get the relief, right? Because skinning it doesn't really give you any relief. It just gives you basically just putting it on a flat surface, right? So that would really be the trick, would be able to get the relief in it in order to be able to 3D print a realistic object. And that's what I think would be really, really interesting.
It would be. And that's the other thing that I've been looking at, although it's considerably more expensive, is there are 3D scanners. And then in turn, scanning an individual. I looked at a new one here the other day. Relatively new. I mean, this whole entire technology is new. So
it is groundbreaking.
Two months is considered old now some days in this technology. But this would allow you to actually scan. I watched a video. They were actually scanned a person, and then they actually produced an O-scale, HO-scale, and an N-scale person on an SLA printer.
Yep. Okay.
And it turned out absolutely fantastic. Now, the camera scanner, unfortunately, is about $425. But, you know, it's moving in the right direction, and as technology changes, that's the direction it's going. So I just wanted to share that with you and kind of get some other people thinking in that same realm of, hey, this is something we really can do, and here's a really practical use of it. And, you know, an SLA printer, even the smallest one that you can get about for $280 online at Amazon, you're now talking about being able to produce some really fine scale people with really body shapes and doing
costumes,
things that you really want them to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'll tell you something else along those lines. You've already got a scanner probably in your pocket. Okay.
Yes.
If you haven't checked out yet, there's a particular type of thing called photogrammetry. Okay.
Yep.
And basically that's what the scanners do, but it turns out that there's actually software out there, and some of it's actually free, that you can go, and basically what you do is you take your regular cell phone camera, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, but for the benefit of those people out there who haven't already heard about this stuff, you basically take your cell phone camera, and you take a picture of whatever it is that you want a model of, and if that happens to be, let's say, a person, what you would do is have that perfect dress in the costume that you want them to be printed as. And what you do is you go around and hold the camera up high, and without changing the settings, so the settings, the camera basically is all really about always picking the same type of picture. You go walk around them, and it take about, with the camera held high, you take about 20 pictures, okay? Then you hold the camera at about waist level, and you walk around again all the way around them and take another 20 pictures. And then you hold the camera low and take another 20 pictures. You get 60 pictures altogether, or even 45 if you did 15. That's probably enough. And then you take it and you put it into the software, and it takes all those pictures and it creates reference points, and it'll actually make a 3D model of whatever you're taking the photos of, whether that's a little green frog or whether it's a human being or a car. And you've already got the camera in your pocket.
Wow.
Digital camera. And you can take anything, and then it'll basically put that whole thing together as a 3D model. And all you have to do then at that point is scale it and print it, and you're done.
Yep, yep.
And that's just mind-blowing.
And it is interesting because I have looked at that program. I actually have it downloaded, but I haven't played with it yet. But, yeah, this is where I think in many cases – for the modeler, I mean, when we look at 3D printing and we look at that, this is the type of stuff that I think a lot of the people are getting excited about.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I know I'm very excited about it. I haven't done it yet, but, boy, I'm looking forward to it.
So, yeah, that's what I wanted to share on the 3D printing. I thought you – but there's if you go to Adobe and you look up a program called Fuse, it's a free program, and you can actually create – the body type. So if you want a fat person, thin person, male, female, muscular, older, baby, whatever you want, you can create these characters, but they're in that standard human T shape. And then, you know, they have a bone structure and everything already. It's getting imposed so that you can actually print them is the issue.
Oh, so that's really neat. Okay. I definitely got to check that out. Fuse. Okay, cool.
Yeah. 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 So it's worth taking a look at it. And again, I think that, you know, if you already have that basic structure, it's just a matter of being able to move those points in the bone structure that you created in that character. You should be able to pose them from there.
That makes excellent point sense. Yeah, that's very cool.
But I'm not a software genius. I just understand how it kind of works a bit.
All right. Well, you know, I mean, if I don't, I'm sure somebody in the audience probably will. And hopefully we'll hear something from people. And, you know, let's get this moving. This is, like, amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And we are really, like I said last time, we're getting to a point where there's literally almost nothing you can't model anymore.
Oh, agreed. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it does address, you know, an interesting problem, and you're right, because, let's just face it, there's only so many different types of characters that you can even come across, and sooner or later you're going to have stuff that's recognizable across several different layouts and stuff like that if you have people that are, you know, into modeling that aspect of it. And probably really, too, it's just, like you're saying, really hard to find something that fits what you're doing. Like, for instance, Craig, I mean, finding characters that are appropriate for your era would probably be next to nearly impossible.
Well, it is possible. There's bits and pieces. There was years ago, there was a company called Musket Miniatures, which may still be around, and they had some period people. And then there's a fellow named Andrew Stadden in UK, who does some really nice OO scale, which is slightly different. I think it's 176 instead of 180. It's pretty close, but he does some nice figures, also from the Victorian period, England, but it's very close. But yeah, it's tough. It's not easy to find people, you know, that look appropriate for my era.
Right, right. So, Mike, unless there's something you wanted to add to that.
The idea is that I'd kind of been hanging around there and kind of listening to the show going, hey, this is right up our alley here.
Yeah, that is right on the money what we're about to, so. Well, Mike, one of the things I wanted to ask you, because honestly, have we had you on? I know we've talked a lot, but is this your first time on the Model Railcast show, or have you been on?
This is my first time
Okay. How about that? Okay. So, Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit then about what you're modeling. It's a little out of order of what I had sent you, but just basically what your main layout is and what you're modeling in the era.
Okay, well, I'm modeling the Colorado Front Range, and I'm basically prototype. We'll get into prototype in a minute, but I'm building a prototype railroad that basically runs. The first staging yard is coming out of Cheyenne. The first visible building city on the layout is Loveland. And then it runs all the way to Colorado Springs to the other staging yard, which is Pueblo, Colorado. But my staging yard is a through staging yard. So when you come out from one end, you basically complete a circle back down into the staging yard on the other end.
Okay, gotcha.
So it's in a building that is 28 by 32 feet, so about 900 square feet, single shelf. I do not like multi-deck layouts. Not against anybody who does it. Just I'm 55 and I don't like bending over to do wiring.
I am 56 and I can totally agree with that.
So and the layout is the era that I'm modeling is, you know, I've heard everybody say about how I believe it's the B&O or C&O, whatever. They didn't dieselize until late. Well, I'm modeling the Colorado and Southern in 1959, because in 1959 they still had 48 steam locomotives that they were running on that line.
Wow.
Nice. Okay.
And also in 1959 is when the when they introduced the brand new Chinese red diesel locomotives to the CB&Q.
Ah, okay, the Chinese red ones. Yeah, okay.
So at that time in 1959 you have, you know, steam locomotives, 210-2s, Consolidations, Mikados, all running along with the Blackbirds and the brand new Chinese Reds.
Very nice.
So it gives me an excuse to do that. And then if I switch to the second part is if I want to remove all the steam locomotives off the layout, then I'm modeling about 1965.
Ah, see?
Okay. That's a good range. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, so, you know, it gives me a chance if it's just one of those, you know what, I don't want to fight with steam locomotives this week or I'm having problems with, yeah, let's take those off and let's just run diesels. Right. So
nice, too, because with 1959, too, you've really got quite the flexibility with rolling stock that's available to you.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, because, you know, World War II ended, and matter of fact, 1959, I believe we're in the Korean War at this time.
Okay.
I believe that's it, or getting to the end of it. And so, you know, you still have a lot of old rolling stock that's being used from World War II, still being used.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being replaced slowly and surely. And new things are starting to show up, these things called covered hoppers.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay. That would be about the right time, yeah.
Yeah, so you get this real change of what's going on, and it's a real transition period. And because the Colorado Southern is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Q, you know, they can't do anything without getting permission from the parent company. And they're their redheaded stepchild. I mean, even when the merger occurred, they weren't included in it.
Oh, wow.
Is that right? I did not know that.
Yeah, neither them or the Fort Worth and Denver. Neither one of them were included in the merger, and they were both solely owned by the Q. And so they were, you know, basically redheaded stepchildren. That they were. You can't run that green and black.
That was my next question. Was it by the merger you meant Burlington Northern then?
Yeah, by the merger to Burlington Northern, they were held off. So in the 1970s, they were still running. It wasn't until like 72, 73 or somewhere later that they finally became part of the BN.
Okay.
Mm, okay.
Well,
so
you learn something new every day.
Yeah.
So
one of the things that I noticed and one of the reasons why this caught my attention was you had mentioned sugar beets being a big thing on your railroad. One of my favorite engines is on the Strasburg Railroad. It's number 90. And it's a decapod, and it's a 210-0, so that's a decapod, right?
Yeah, that's a decapod.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting, Mike, because like you said, it worked on the Great Western Railroad out in the Midwest. I think that's Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
That's all it did was it just hauled, well, at least that's what it was famous for out there, was just hauling long sugar beet trains. And it probably did that, I think, up until about 1961 or so,
yep.
And possibly even a little bit later. And it pretty much never went inactive. As soon as it was done there, Strasburg quickly pounced on it, and they just, you know, it just came east under its own power. So it never really experienced retirement, and is still working on the Strasburg today. Is their strongest engine out there. But I always had a special affinity. But I was also sort of fascinated too, because it always seems like they emphasized that it had hauled sugar beets, and it just seems like there's something that seems to set that sort of railroading apart from the others. Am I getting a correct read on that, or am I just sort of pulling something out that doesn't exist?
Well, the sugar beet industry is it actually started back in, well, and then let's go back to the Great Western Sugar Company. So the first Great Western Sugar Company built their first sugar mill around 1890, so around your time, your modeling, Craig, at Grand Island, Iowa.
Okay.
Is that Iowa or Nebraska? Grand Island. I think it's Iowa. I think it's Nebraska. Okay. Someone will correct me, I'm sure. But
someone always, you know, does.
Yeah, always. And I apologize already ahead of time, so don't beat me up too bad. But they built their one of their first sugar mills right there, and the sugar mill industry is huge. It was huge in Europe. So when we started producing sugar here in the United States, this was a very large industry. As a matter of fact, to the point of on the layout, I'm modeling two particular sugar mills, the one in Longmont and the one in Loveland. They were built in about 1903. So these, 1901 and 1903 for these two sugar mills. And these are very large buildings. I mean, enormously large.
Mm-hmm. Now you're talking
Iceland. Yeah, I mean, these things, if we were to actually model them into scale, they would be about 25 feet long.
Oh, my.
So these things are huge.
Right.
And as far as railroad goes, I mean, when they first were produced, and this is really kind of interesting to see the relationship between the Great Western Sugar Company and the Burlington and the UP, and how they created this industry in the western states. To give you an idea, there are in between Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and the west end of Nebraska, there are probably close to 18 sugar mills.
Mm.
Wow.
And these sugar mills, they basically, the Great Western came to the Q and the UP and said, we need to get more sugar beets to these mills. And they already had an agriculture division built up within there. And so these guys were out there promoting these farmers to grow sugar beets. So they were growing wheat and barley and sugar beets.
Hmm, okay.
Very
interesting. So, and to the tune that by 1920, these mills were producing about 2,500 tons daily of sugar.
Wow.
That's a lot of sugar.
Our appetite definitely increased for sugar.
Yeah.
So, fellas, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least take a minute or so to say, how cool is it that a big boy is running again?
It's pretty neat.
Yeah, I've been watching it from afar, and I think the real excitement built when the first time they took it out of the roundhouse and they were steaming it up to fire the whistle off.
Yep.
Oh, yes.
That was a great moment.
that was just kind of shattering for me. I just looked at my wife and I said, 60 years is a long time.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah, it's been great the last couple of weeks watching everything on YouTube, the Foamerpocalypse. You know,
yep.
I got to give credit to Rob Spangler. He's the one who came up with that. But what a great statement. Foamerpocalypse. And it was so appropriate, too.
You know what's amazing to me, though, is it just I think, you know, in conversations I've had with both of you,
mm-hmm.
you know, this basically, I think in today's day and age, the only real obstacle to getting any locomotive running again is just money. And if that's there, it can happen pretty much.
Well, yeah, it goes with just about anything, but absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you go back, I mean, I, as a little boy, I was always like, oh, I want to see a big boy running again. And people are like, oh, it just can't happen, you know, it just will never happen.
That's it.
And I do think that there was while we had the technology issue, I think it was practically prohibitive. But now, I mean, goodness, it seems like the sky's the limit.
Well, it really takes, as much as people get down on the UP, you know, it really takes a company that has a real, you know, appreciation for its own history and is willing to put, like you were saying, the money up to do something like this for public relations, and not only that, but just for their own, you know, their own history, their own, you know, it's really heartwarming in a lot of ways.
Yes.
If you can say that about a corporation, but
yeah, no,
they really have their heart in the right place.
Yeah. And it's amazing because so many people gave UP grief over, you remember the whole copyrights on their name from models and everything else.
Plus them gobbling up all the other railroads out west.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet here they've done something that we need to give them credit for. I mean, I can remember I used to go to Cheyenne quite a bit, and I can remember that big boy sitting in the park.
Mm.
And the excitement when I came out one time and it was all covered up in plastic and a note saying that it was being moved back to the roundhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's neat.
And my response was, what? Say what?
You're doing what?
Yeah.
Oh, just a great moment.
Yeah, it really was very cool. I mean, some of those pictures that people took were just amazing. You know, I know, I think it's Kevin Burkholder, I think, is one of the guys who I know on Facebook. And he's a professional railroad photographer. And he put up some images that were just jaw-dropping. I mean, really, really great stuff. So if you haven't had the chance to try to friend him on Facebook or like that, look up his name like that. He took some amazing shots. And he's also done some, I think he does work mostly for Central Vermont and the Vermont Railway and stuff like that. Okay. That's his primary thing. And he's done some really incredible shots of that too. So if you get a chance, look him up. Some really amazing photography.
And what was that name again?
Kevin Burkholder.
Kevin Burkholder.
I believe that's
okay, excellent.
I'll correct that later if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I'll just edit it in.
So this entire area, matter of fact, the Colorado Southern's entire business model in many ways was all wrapped around agriculture. So they were moving grain just like they do today, getting it from the fields, getting it to the elevators, getting it to the mills, getting it, you know, the flour then to the bakeries and to everybody else just like they do today. But they were now with sugar, they were harvesting picking up these sugar beets, and in particular, I like to model on the layout in the September-October timeframe, which is when the sugar beet runs occur. And the reason why the CNS had engines running as late as 1959 was because earlier in 59, in February of 59, they had some diesel accidents that took out four of their diesel locomotives.
Oh, man. That'll set you back if you're a short line.
That's right. And so you just got set back. So they ended up having to pull out all these 2102 locomotives to actually, because they had a bumper crop that year, and they literally just had to get these beets in. And it was extremely important to get these beets into the mills as quickly as possible during the season.
Man, wow.
So that's what the sugar mill industry, I think, is, you know, we look at it from sugar, but it's also the byproducts that it produces. One of the byproducts of the sugar mill is they make sugar, but then they get molasses, and then they take the beet pulp with that molasses and they make cattle feed.
Right.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely multi uses there.
Oh, yeah. So the mills themselves would take in sugar beets. And, of course, bags and everything for packing the whole thing. But their other commodities that would come in would be coal for their boiler houses. They would take in limestone for purifying the sugar and coke for making that limestone and all turn into a calcium carbonate to purify the sugar. So you have, you know, maybe a car of coke, three cars of coal, and you'd end up with, you know, maybe 10 or 12 cars of limestone coming in addition to the trains, the sugar beet trains coming in.
That's pretty neat.
So it's a very heavy industry bringing in, and a lot of these sugar mills had yards sitting outside where they were called transfer yards, that they were basically, you know, bringing in coal, taking coal cars out, bringing in, you know, and bringing in the sugar beets to be put through the processing plant.
Right.
So it's a very high intensity area, and then, like I said, you know, they're producing sugar all year long. But originally, in the beginning, they were only processing sugar during that fall to winter season, then they would kind of shut down, and then the warehouse would feed everything they needed to. But as time went on, by the time the 1950s, they were running pretty much around the clock.
How about that?
That's neat.
So,
and Mike, when did you say that sugar industry started out there? What time? You said it was around the turn of the century?
Yeah, about 1901 was when Longmont, Loveland got its first plant. The Longmont plant was built in 1903. I'm trying to think some of the other places. You had Windsor, Greeley, Sterling, Fort Morgan, Bush, Fort Collins. All these sugar mills were built around that time frame, and they were all the great Western sugar mills, which then formed the Great Western Sugar Railroad, because they actually moved the products around to get and what they needed to each of these stations. Now, they also had sugar mills in Wyoming, so they had one in Wheatland, in Warland, Sheridan, Loveland, and then they went up into Montana hitting Billings and Harding. So the Q and the CNS service to a lot of these sugar mills.
Amazing. Thank you.
How would they be hauling these sugar beets? Like, basically, what I'm picturing is we used to have these trains in South Jersey. We called them sand hogs. And that it was basically just a long, for all intents and purposes, they were unit trains before they were called unit trains. Because South Jersey's number one export seems to be sand. And we've got lots of it. And so there would just be these 55-plus car gondola trains, and there's actually even, you know, this is again one of the reasons why I love modeling the PRSL in the time period, Mike, similar to what you're saying, because like it gives me an excuse to run all kinds of different locomotives doing stuff you wouldn't think. There's actually a picture in the archives of a Pennsylvania Railroad K4 that had nothing else to do, so they sent it down to Millville, and you can see it there, you know, this beautiful passenger locomotive that's pulling a 50 car long train of gondolas just loaded with sand. So quite the opposite of what you expect out of a K4. So all that to say is with the sugar beets, primarily what kind of rolling stock was the railroad using to move those?
So they used a drop bottom gondolas in gondolas. Originally they started off with just gondolas, but let's back up a little bit. So when they first came out, they were actually bringing the sugar beets by horse and carriage.
Okay.
You know, wagons, not carriages, but wagons. And then eventually, because of so much, they actually were producing tons and tons of sugar beets because it was a very good crop, an easy crop for them to grow, that they ended up switching to the railroad. So the earliest trains I can see are about 1909 delivering these sugar beets. And they were basically a gondola with plywood size that raised them up high, because the beets aren't heavy.
Okay, I was curious about that, because I know sand's heavy, so that's why we use the gondolas, because we just cube things out. But
so if you look at the Southern Pacific, they used to have sugar beet cars too, and they would do the same thing. They were drop bottom gondolas or gondolas with big long slats that came up that probably were, you know, made them twice as tall as what a normal gondola would be.
Mm-hmm.
And the farmers would then in turn just basically, you know, bring their to the loading areas, and they would bring their wagons, and they would literally scoop or dump or whatever, depending on the site. They would dump these beets into these cars, and then these cars would then ship them straight to the sugar mill, where they would start the process of washing them. And even within the Great Western, depending on what sugar mill you go to, would depend on how they designed the cars to be unloaded. They were all different.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that makes sense.
So at Loveland, they had the drop bottoms would drop, and they would drop, so they would roll them up like, you know, like you would see on a coal thing. They would push them up a trestle that would set it up high, and then they'd open them up, and then it would drop out like you would see in a coal drop. At Longmont, they had what they called a wet rack, and they would take these in, and they would use steaming water, because it would be freezing sometimes, and so these sugar beets would be frozen together. But they would take these this warm water and wash it down, and then it would wash it down into a trough underneath where it would go into like a canal system that would then begin the washing process and bring them right into the plant to be processed.
I wonder if they had much trouble. I know I've heard stories about places that took coal, and especially ones that used regular hoppers. But then eventually sometimes they'd end up getting a gondola and they would just swear up and down because then they'd have to shovel the thing out.
Yeah.
They didn't like that.
Well, it's interesting because I'm working on the Longmont quite a bit. And I think you've seen photographs of some of that, what we've been working on. But I was looking at these coal pits and I'm like, okay, they're the same level that how do they, you know, and I'm looking at the cars and I'm like, they're using a standard gondola. How are they getting the coal out of the cars into these pits?
Yeah.
And so I contacted another friend of mine, George Booth, who is modeling the Great Western, and he's modeling in about 1965. And so I called George up, and I said, George, how did they get the coal? And he goes, oh, well, you're going to be familiar with the American Crane Company, and they use clamshells to empty the gondolas out and then finish shoveling out by hand into these pits.
Yep, makes sense.
Wow, how about that?
And then they would go in when they needed a load of coal for the boiler house. They would clamshell it up, take the crane, and pull it back with a little dinky, and then drop it into the pit where it would go into the boiler house.
That's resourceful.
And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of work and a lot of labor. But it just all of a sudden you start to realize the operations you can create with just the mill itself.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems very, you know, it's interesting because all the stuff you're describing, it seems very comparable to like the model railroads who model steel mill operations.
Very much so.
Yeah,
pretty much any really large industry has those opportunities because, it, like Mike's saying, there's going to have all different kinds of things going on. It's not just, you know, product in, product out.
Right.
You know, there's all this other stuff going on, whether it's machinery and other, you know, like coal coming in. It, there's all kinds of great opportunities.
Yeah.
And then look what you end up. You end up bringing in these gondolas, you bring in the sugar beet cars and everything else. And then what are you shipping out of there? Well, you're shipping out, you know, box cars full of cattle feed, of sugar, of, you know, and even if you begin to model later, now you've got covered gondolas that you're pulling sugar out of, and you still have box cars pulling feed and things like that out of it, or gondola.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike, I have one real little question about that. We're just talking about how they shipped the sugar. Obviously, they shipped it in bags a lot of the time. Did they ever, before covered hoppers, did they ever ship sugar loose in boxcars at all?
Not loose.
Okay.
I've got photographs into the 30s and 40s where they actually are. They're, you look in their warehouse, and it's from the inside of the warehouse you can see it, and they literally have these 15-pound bags of sugar.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And it's not paper. Well, they're kind of a – they look like a burlap bag, but they have paper or something inside there that's holding all the sugar in there.
Right, because it would just leak out.
Obviously. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that was what you see. Now, I don't know when they begin to make the change, but all of a sudden – what you find today is, okay, like today, you know, the U.S. is still the number three producer of sugar in the world, behind Russia and France. They're producing about 33 million tons a year.
Okay.
And so this sugar is, at some point, then went to distributors, and then from there they actually broke it down into smaller bags. So at some point during this, and not during the time that I'm modeling, although by the 60s, I think you probably would begin to see this where they would, because covered hoppers were now very common then, you would then in turn have these covered hoppers then taking the sugar to distribution points to then, you know, make to where you would get it to the grocery store.
Right. So that's kind of what I was wondering, because I know that other loose commodities like sand and grain and like that, a lot of times they would just put them directly into a tight boxcar. But I can imagine sugar would be too fine, probably.
Well, and just any water wrecks it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, wrecks it, and you probably open it up at the end, and there's nothing in the car.
Exactly. So, you know, the Q adopted cement hoppers and things like that really early in their mm-hmm. history.
For
very obvious reasons. So mm-hmm. for them, it probably made sense that they probably made that adjustment. I think the first covered hoppers, I think in one of my books, becomes around 59, 60 mm-hmm. When they're first coming out. And the Q immediately adopts them because they see the value in because of their dealing with the sugar industry.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, because it's a lot of labor to you know, bag it up and move those bags around and everything like that. That's an awful lot of men's backs and like that. It's
exactly.
You know, it takes time. It takes materials. It's, you know, so by absolutely anything to go to simplify that process, you know, and make it a bulk process makes a huge difference.
Yeah, so if you're modeling this time frame, this is really, you know, and believe me, sugar mill, studying sugar mill, I mean, I learned about a Hoffman house. I had no idea what a Hoffman house was, but I was doing a study. I was working on building this sugar mill, and next to the boiler house is this thing called the Hoffman house. And I'm like, what the heck is a Hoffman house?
Right.
And so what it is one of the latest developments in sugar beets in the early 40s, late 30s, somewhere around there, is they found out that they could take the molasses again and run it through, like, what do they call the towers that they break the oil up?
Fracking tower.
So they basically, it's kind of like a fracking tower. They take this molasses into this tower and they heat it and they pump through there a calcium bicarbonate. And that in turn crystallizes more sugar out of that molasses that they get, and it gives them more sugar. So they get more return out of that sugar beet.
Right. Okay.
And then that, once it comes out, now you've got a very dark molasses that's left that has very little sugar left in it. And it has much of the healthy potassium and other things that the cattle need that goes into the feed, and you're not giving them as much sugar. And we're bringing more sugar out of this product. And I was like, okay, what is this? And then I had to get, you know, and that's how you get down that rabbit trail and you begin to go, okay, now I know why we do what we do and why you see.
Right. There you go.
So yeah, there was a lot of things that, and then, you know, when I found out, okay, so how do they actually, they would have this, and it's not on my railroad because it's just too big and I didn't have any room for it, but they had the pulp house. So the pulp would come out, and after they boiled it and got the sugar out of it, they then would take this pulp and they would throw it into this pulp house and allow it to dry. And that mixed with the feed, with the dark molasses, what eventually became that cattle feed, and then they bagged that up.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Boy, Tim, I think when you woke up this morning, you probably didn't think you'd be talking about the incredible developments in the sugar industry, right?
I have to say, you know, I don't think I suspected that. But you know what, though? It's funny because we joke, but it does make sense. I mean, how oftentimes, you talk about modeling an industry on a model railroad, and very seldom it seems like, is it just a straight up, this one thing comes in and this one thing goes out? Yeah, there's just a lot.
Well, exactly. You know, and that's the fun part about this. Like Michael is saying, you learn all this incredible stuff that, you know, you never had any idea, you know, but it's fascinating.
It is. And then, you know, Craig, I know I contacted you maybe a couple of years ago. I was kind of dealing with this. So on my layout, Denver is a hub. It is a divisional endpoint for a lot of the railroads that service Denver. It's also a through point. So on my layout, the divisional endpoint is the middle of the layout.
Okay.
So unlike everything on a lot of layouts where they're coming from a division and they're going at locals coming out of here, all my trains come to Denver.
Okay.
And then in Denver, in Rice Yard, they break them down into the locals that will go out to these locations.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can imagine the operations then become, so you're coming off from the staging yard and you might have a coal train, a drag train coming through with just coal.
Right.
And they're going straight through, they're passing through all these industries that this coal is going to, but it's going to end up in Denver, where it then breaks it up into, so there's a coal burning electric plant in Colorado Springs. So most of the coal is going to go that direction. But we have two sugar mills that need coal too, and so they're going to, you know, be getting about 3 to 6 cars each.
Mm-hmm.
So that train is going to be broken up, and you might get a local drag going to the electric plant where they're going to provide coal for them to feed coal down there. But there's then two locals that are going to basically be running out to the sugar mills to bring coal, coke, limestone and the beets.
Of course. Yeah, so the question then is, did they take the coal off then at Denver in order to switch it out of those trains, or did they take it to the processing plant first and then cut that off and bring it back?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one of the things in all the research I was doing, so Denver is this huge railroad hub in the 50s. It is an enormous railroad hub, to the point of there are literally 9 turntables in Denver.
Wow. Wow.
Okay.
9 turntables in Denver. The Pullman Company has one. The Q has 3. Denver Rio Grande has one. Denver shares a turntable with the Santa Fe, because they had the Rice Yard was a joint yard, Santa Fe Q yard. And then the UP has one, has a couple of them in there too. So you've got all these railroads, and then railroads that come in, like the Rock Island, come into Denver for passenger service. The Missouri Pacific comes in. So you have all these additional kind of strange railroads that all they did is they brought passengers to Denver and then turned around and went right back out, right down the same track they came in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when you look at this operation on the layout, that's why I say we can focus freight or we can focus passenger. If we were to focus passenger, we literally have... There are 8 named trains that come into Denver Union Station.
Mm. Wow.
I never dreamed that Denver was actually that bus line.
Well, it's really interesting. And if anyone wants to see it, you can go to the U.S. Geological Maps and pull up the map of Denver. It's in 4 separate sections.
Mm-hmm.
And you pull it up, and you pull up something that's from about the 1950s or earlier, you will literally see that Rice Yard goes from Denver Union Station all the way to the river, which is now nothing but buildings today.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow.
And it was about 2 miles long of yards wide. Of yards
wide?
Wide.
Okay, now that's impressive.
I mean, this thing is enormous, and you just see the loading and unloading. The freight houses are all there. There, next to Union Station is a giant post office that was a block long and probably 6 stories high.
Okay.
So all this is coming into Denver. So that's why I ended up modeling this, because I'm like, wow, talk about an opportunity. If you get tired of one railroad, you can see another railroad, and it would still be prototypically correct.
Wow, that's pretty neat.
I love that kind of flexibility.
Yeah, very impressive.
So real quick, Mike, then, and that's some great information. Now, I know you've got a pretty good-sized layout, and one of the things I was curious, because I remember – you had another one that got torn down, and you started building the current one. And here we are several years later, and I was just curious as you could just share with us some lessons that you've learned along the way with this new layout.
Well, lesson number one, and this goes from building any layout. There is no bad size layout, small, large, whatever. But one of the things that I really... You know, I've been modeling for 40 years, and I know, Craig, you've seen the same thing. Tim, I'm sure you've seen it too. When you look at model railroads, we see the same kits on all these railroads.
Sure.
And it's funny. I can look at them and go, I know that kit. I know that kit. And the one thing that I really learned, especially with building large layouts, matter of fact, that was one of the goals when I was building this layout, was buildings are bigger than train cars.
Yep.
And it's so important. I mean, not beating up on any manufacturer out there, whatever, but, you know, when I see a grain elevator and it's the size of 2 boxcars standing straight up, I'm like, why would the railroad bother?
Right. I mean, there was a reason why they called them prairie skyscrapers.
Right.
So if you look at my buildings, I know... you know, I have a laser, so a lot of the buildings I'm doing are scratch-built buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't have to do that. My first response is, I saw a layout the other day that took the old Bachmann skyscraper, the Art Deco one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they had taken probably about 6 of these kits together and made a building that looked like a Art Deco, but the correct size. It was enormous.
Okay.
You know, it was probably like 6 panels wide. you know, and three panels tall. And I looked at it and it went, that's how you use that kit.
Yep.
And that's exactly what the goal was on this layout. So if you're going to build a large layout, the very first rule that I would say is, yeah, kits are neat. Look at them for kit bashing.
Right. It's
5.7.
It's a building block.
Yes. Mm-hmm. How can I put 5, 6, or 7 together? The other thing is when you're building a large layout, big buildings are very helpful.
Oh, yeah. They cover up a lot of space. A
lot of space. And you can then justify, why do I have a yard here? You know, my Longmont Peninsula is just one side of a peninsula, and it's 25 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
So on there, I have the sugar mill and all of its facilities and its things, and that's probably 8 feet, maybe 9 feet long, that whole industry there.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other end of town in Longmont was the turkey plant that they slaughtered turkeys and did turkeys, and it was called the Longmont Foods.
Okay.
And that is another 33-inch long building that has, you know, 4 railroad cars. And then across the street from that, it will be the Prairie Skyscraper. The obvious, you know, you can't work in Colorado and not have the elevators or the mills that are there.
Right, right.
Because that's what they grow.
It's all about the agriculture, yeah.
Yeah, so by doing that, I end up putting, what, 3 industries in this 25-foot area, and it justifies why a local is going to stop in a town.
Makes perfect sense. Preach it, brother. Preach it.
Yeah, we love that.
Anybody who's listening to this show long enough knows I love big buildings.
Yes.
Oh, you know, it's funny. So I did Denver, and of course, Denver has Union Station.
Of course.
Now, modeling Union Station in HO scale is another one of these prohibited buildings. I mean, unless you want to spend 15 feet of your layout in just Union Station. Not saying someone can't do it, but that's how big it would be.
Sure, yeah.
So when I built Union Station, I actually got it's not a kit. I contacted the what is it CMR? CRM?
Yep, Custom Model Railroads, yep.
Custom Model Railroads. So they had this Denver Union Station, and I kind of contacted them and said, well, how much for Denver Union Station? Well, I built them, they cost $7,000.
Okay.
And I was like, wow. Well, that's more than
thank
I can.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
And but I kind of bopped back and forth, and I bought a couple of his kits, and eventually I contacted him. I said, can you just send me the parts for Denver Union Station? I'll pay for the parts and your labor and whatever it takes. Just send me the parts. And he sent me a message that says, Mike, I don't have any instructions. And I said, well, if you saw my railroad and knew what I was doing, I don't need no stinking instructions.
Exactly.
I need the parts.
Exactly, yes.
I've got plenty.
I'll figure it out. Yeah.
And so that's what I ended up doing, and it was made out of acrylic. Okay. I had never worked with acrylic before.
Okay.
I worked with this. Well, his kits are out of acrylic, and so that, like I said, a little bit. So but learning the gluing and getting all these pieces together. But it took me, you know, I do this YouTube channel, and there are people like, why don't you get it done faster? I'm like, well, you know, it takes me 4 to 5 months to build a building, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it takes time. Yeah.
It takes time. And but to build that Union Station probably took me about 6 months to build.
Mm-hmm. I believe it.
But it's probably about, I think it's 38 inches long. And you can literally put an E-unit and 4 80-foot passenger cars in front of it, and they're all in front of the building.
Nice.
So that gives it some reality. And so when you see it, it looks like, yeah, this is truly a Denver – this is truly a Union Station.
I got you. All right.
So – and yeah, it's nice. Just – that's the kind of stuff that when I was building it, and if you're building a large layout, do not look to the kits. Look at them as building blocks of what you're going to do.
Exactly.
The other thing I would say is don't be afraid of – I mean, most people can draw in 2D CAD. Today's modeler, I think, is more than capable. There's plenty of programs out there that get experience with, you know, NeRails and all these type of things. If you can draw anything in that CAD program, you can use a laser.
Absolutely, yes.
It is not that difficult.
Mm-hmm. That or Corel Draw, that's the other option. And that's
exactly.
Actually fairly easy, you know?
Yeah, I use Corel quite a bit. It's very handy. And you can then in turn, you know, today's lasers are not that expensive. I know Ron Kleiss, you guys know very well.
Yeah.
I do know Ron well, yes.
So Ron kind of was following me when I was getting the laser and dealing with all these type of things. And he got interested in it, and he calls me and says, what do I need to do for a laser? And I said, and he asked me, what would I get if I had to buy it again? And I said, well, that's why I built my own. But but that's because that's what my job is. So it's a little different. But today you can get, if you're building a large layout, an investment in a laser for, you know, $1,000, let's be fair about it. Craftsman kits cost how much?
About $100 to $150 or more.
So if you buy three Craftsman kits, because those really are the size, you'd need a large layout to really display them, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Because they would fit those needs. So if you look at that three, four laser kits, now justify why you're buying that laser?
Yep. Oh, yeah. No, hey, you don't have to convince me. I believe it. I know it.
And so if you're doing that, learning the skill to do it. I know that, for instance, my Longmont Foods plant, I needed, that's a cement building, in which you got the rib sides that are on the outside.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Well, you can't find that anymore as a kit anywhere.
That's true. They are hard to find now.
They are gone. And mm-hmm. So you can find them occasionally on eBay, but it's only a smaller portion, and I needed this big building.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So you end up drawing it up. And so I think that I would say today, you know, what is the golden age of model railroading? Well, it's today.
Yeah,
I think you're right. I would totally agree with that statement.
Yeah, I totally
because you
would.
Can now 3D print, use a laser, you can practically scratch build any prototype model you want. You have photographs, you can build it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's true. I mean, it's, you know, they don't have there's not a lot of skill in terms of modeling, in terms of doing these things necessarily to do it. So, you know, it is mostly software and, you know, the right pieces of hardware. But really, it's not that different from the old days when you had to, you know, draw the plans yourself on paper, you know, and then if you were, I guess what I'm trying to say is if you can get comfortable with the idea of scratch building and then learn a little software like you're saying, then you can literally build anything.
Yeah.
And it takes building, and this is not to discourage kit manufacturers because you have to build those kits first to learn the skills to actually draw these things up and how to put them together.
That is very true. Actually, when I was first learning how to do laser cut stuff, that was exactly the thing. I built two or three kits just to learn how it all went together, and then I was able to use that information in order to design my own.
Exactly. It's not any different.
No.
The other thing that I would say that I learned is, now, to be fair, Craig and me probably both were idiots hand building turnouts long before Fast Track were.
Yeah, I did build a few by hand. No doubt.
And I'm going to be honest. It was probably around 1995, 96. I was building a logging layout.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed some really unique turnouts. Stub turnouts and different things like that. I was playing around with really short turnouts, number fours and things like that. And nothing against Atlas's products or any of those type of things, but they just didn't fit the prototype of a logging railroad.
Sure, yeah.
And so I contacted a friend of mine, Mike Whiteman, who is now 77 years old or so. And Mike had been modeling. Mike was a rubber scaler. He's hand laid S scale turnouts. He's done those type of things. So I kind of was, okay, Mike, show me how to do this. Now this is literally 3-4 years before Fast Tracks gets developed.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike is showing me how to do this, and I'm you know, I've got my vise and my files, and I'm filing the stock rails, and I'm making the frogs, you know, filing the middle and bending them and doing all this stuff. And I'm building my own jigs and drawing things up. And it literally is a pain in the butt.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's brutally difficult.
Yes.
And, but I get a couple build, and I just kind of throw this thing on the shelf and say, screw this, I'm not building this logging layout.
Mm.
And set it aside and decided to build another simple railroad to go. and because I just can't stand not modeling, and so I'm constantly modeling. Well, then 3 years later, a company comes out by the name of Fast Tracks, and I jump on this thing fairly early because I am just stoked by this thing.
Oh yeah,
now,
I did too.
and I'm going to just be honest with a lot of people. I didn't just buy one jig. I bought three jigs and stockades and everything that Tim was selling. And it, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a crack addiction.
Oh, it really is. It is.
And I started building these turnouts. And today I have probably built over 500 turnouts with Fast Tracks. And to the tune of I build my own double slip switches, my own three ways. I have a custom curved crossing.
Hmm.
So one is coming through at 36 inch radius and the other one's coming through at 42 inch radius and they're crossing over one another.
Wow. Okay. You're a glutton for punishment, ain't you?
Well, I did a video on how I did it and I basically had drawn everything out because I had taken CAD and I printed the layout at 1:1 so I could lay it down. And I just took the flex track and just drew the rails, just ran a crayon over the top of it and then the rails. And that created the angles. And then I'm like, okay, well, I got the angles.
Yeah, that's all you need.
All I need now is just to simply lay the rails.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I guess the point that I'm making is that, you know, Craig, you know as well as I do. I have right now 90 turnouts on the layout. 90 turnouts averaging even $10 a piece.
Yeah, do the math, right?
That's $900.
Easily, yeah.
And that's a lot of money. Now go and buy in commercial ones. Oh, and buy something that looks good.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Now talking $20 a turnout.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or more.
Or more.
And good luck on trying to find exactly what you need.
Exactly. And one of the things that my crossings on my layout, all the crossings that are high-speed crossings, are done in number 12 turnouts.
There you go. You can't buy those.
You can't buy those. And by the way, between the frogs on the crossing, mm-hmm. an 80-foot passenger car fits. And it's not touching either frog.
How about that?
So you're talking true high-speed crossovers.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And And you can build those for, I think I calculated up, I think buying the ties and everything to it cost me maybe $7.
Sounds about right, yeah. There's no question about it. They're definitely more economical and they work better than the commercial ones. We all know that. You know, there's literally, you know, no reason I can think of why anybody shouldn't be doing this. You know, besides the fact that when you learn it, all of a sudden, after you've done a dozen of them, you know how to hand lay a turnout.
Yep.
And if you need to make something custom, then no big deal. You've done this a dozen times.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I think, Tim, you commented, I posted some, my logging train.
Yes.
Going back to logging train. My wife is like, where's the logging train at? I know it's out in the train shop. Mm-hmm. We're getting older. I'd like to see that.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't have a place to really display it. My office is full already with 3D printers and display cases and everything else. Mm-hmm. Well, no, I was thinking, could you put it on the shelf over the TV and build a diorama?
Oh, that's a keeper.
I'm on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really? Pitch fire. Tell me I'm still
on it. So I immediately pull out my Sierra West engine facility, which is the photographs I took that you saw, Tim, of Colorado and Coyote Creek. My first large railroad is alive and well again today in a diorama. One of my chaise are sitting in there, rewiring all the lights on it. I'm building another Sierra West freight house that I had stashed away. I was like, where am I going to ever use this kit? Well, ding, 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 my wife got the answer. And so I have the Sierra West logging train, the Sierra West engine facility, and the freight house are all going up on a diorama that's probably 42 inches long by 12 inches deep.
Nice.
Very nice.
And all the rails will be hand-laid, including any turnouts.
Very good.
Because you can.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because you can. Thank you.
I love it. Yeah. And you know, I've said before, like, this is never something that I would have considered within my skill set. I'm not a very precise guy.
You know, between Craig Biscayner and Jim Lincoln working on me, they showed me, you know, I'm not trying to degrade myself, but really, honestly, this was not something I would have ever handling a turnout considered in my ability. And I am confident enough that I feel like any turnout now that I would need for my layout, I'm not saying I would get it right or perfect the first time. I might have to redo some, but I wouldn't hesitate to try.
There you go.
Well, you know, like I said, I've done about 500, and I know Craig's probably in the same boat. And
well, not quite
really
that
what,
many,
well, the reason why I got so many was I had people asking me to build them.
I had them too. I just didn't do it.
Well, I was.
Tim's about the only one I've actually done it for.
Well, I really was being silly, and of course I did it, and I thought, well, you know, I could sell some of these on eBay. And I did try it, and you know what? It just wasn't worth my. It took so much time away from my model railroading.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point now, I mean, I'm sure Craig, you can probably just say I can whip out a number eight or a number six, standard number eight, number six, and it might take me 45 minutes to an hour.
Oh, you're faster than me. It takes me about an hour and 20, but I take my time.
Well, and I'll say that's if I'm rushing it. If I take my time and get, and I know it's in a place, it's a hidden area, and I don't want to do this again.
Well, yeah. Oh no, then you're
yeah. Those ones take me about an hour and 30 minutes. I'm making sure that baby is right.
That's right, and I'm not going back in here again.
That's exactly it. But compared to when I did it by hand with having to do hand jigs and everything else. The skill level definitely drops immensely. You do not need that much skill to
really
create
don't.
these turnouts, and they work like glass.
Yeah, they're amazing.
I mean, you cannot just the idea of you see I can be across a layout and hear a railroad car go through a turnout, and I can identify that's a commercial turnout.
Right.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's you can't miss it.
Nope.
And when I first started building these, my friend Mike Wayman that I told you originally, he looked at me and goes, "My gosh, these things are fantastic."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, "Yeah, I know." It only took me, you know, a little while learning, but to the point now, I mean, I don't think there's not too many jigs. Like I would tell someone if they were buying jigs from Fast Tracks, don't buy a number eight turnout. Don't buy a number eight crossover.
Right, because it's a little more money, but you can get so much more out of it.
Well, you get a crossing plus.
Yeah, the turnout. Exactly. Right.
You get two for the price of one.
Exactly. I wish I'd known that, you know, back in 2003.
Exactly. Well, and I'll say this: if you're glutton for a punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Do a double slip switch.
Yeah.
I did.
You did?
I did. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You nut you.
Yep.
Well, it's not, you have to be much more precise than you do with any of the other things. And because the points are shorter and they're hinged, it is a little, and you know, you got four points that have to hit the rails all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Does three and a half of the points hitting count? I mean,
unfortunately, no.
I did it, Craig. I'm not saying I did a great job at it, but.
Well, and I'll give you a tip, Tim, if you want to, and I picked this up from somebody else. Take aluminum foil and wrap the rail, the stock rail that you're going to bring the point against.
Yeah.
And line them up all against the ones you need to and solder them in place. Then wrap the stock rails of the other points that you're going to hit and flip the turnout the other direction and slip them in. And then wrap them with the tin foil and solder them in place. Because tin foil and solder won't connect.
Yeah. That's a really cool idea.
That is. I didn't know that. But that
and then if you add that tin foil in there, I mean, that's hair thin.
Yeah. There's your tips and tricks for this week. Kate.
That's right.
and talk about being able to get that double slip switch to work perfectly. I can run a 30-car train with a Mikado through my double slip switches at speed, at 55 wow. miles an hour scale and not have a problem.
That's well, aren't you special?
Well, it wasn't easy, Craig. I did not get to put on the layout.
Now, look, I've done a bunch of interesting things, too. I built a three-way that was a straight track and then two turnouts to the right. That was interesting.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that was for Dave's railroad for okay. New York Harbor.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting. I've probably built a half a dozen crossings and other than that. And no, I don't think I would ever try a slip. but it is interesting.
But to your point, once you start building these, you then look at track. Like when I see a prototype and I look at the track and I go, mm-hmm. I can do that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It all of a sudden there's really no obstacle. Thank you. There are no obstacles.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it's like you can literally do anything. Like you were saying a minute ago, Tim, you know, maybe the first time it doesn't work out perfectly, but right. by the time you do it the second time, you've got it.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it just really is worth it. I think that's the other thing.
Yeah, so, all kiddies out there, try this. You know, go yeah. borrow somebody's fast track jig, make a couple. You will be happy for it.
Well, shoot, and even some of the divisions, I know that they've got fast track that you can borrow.
Oh, really? Well, that's nice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know our division does. Not that I personally own more than I need, but I've had other railroaders contact me. And I'm like, yeah, if you want to. Locally here, I'm like, yeah, you guys want to borrow this? Yeah, here. You know, they're sitting in a drawer for me right now. The only time I pull them out is when I need to build a new turnout.
Right.
Right.
All right. Well, we're at an hour and 20, and I'm going to need to start editing this soon. So, Mike, why don't you go ahead and wrap it up with any final thoughts you got for us?
Final thoughts. I would not discourage anyone. You know, to think that I started with a 900-square-foot railroad as my first project, it would be foolish. I have built probably close in my lifetime 14 layouts. I started with small 4x8 sheets of plywood to 4x4 sheets in end scale to small diorama type layouts and things like that. And my response is to anyone, get out of the chair and find something to model.
Yep.
And don't sell yourself short.
Mm.
You can do anything. You know, I sold myself short on painting backdrops.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up now painting over 125 feet of backdrops and working on another 75 feet, so that'll be 200 feet completed here soon. I'd never painted a day until 5 years ago, five years ago.
There you go.
Now, if you watch my video on it, you're going to find out that, yes, I did it 8 times before I got it right the first time.
Yep.
But
the eighth one stayed up.
Yes. And paint is cheap. Don't be discouraged of failure. The Longmont building, I just got done scratch building. I have painted concrete buildings until I'm blue in the face, but I've always done them out of plaster. I had never painted with hardboard before to make it look like concrete. I painted that building 4 times trying to figure out how I was going to make it look like concrete. So even the most experienced modeler has to do things over again.
Right.
Don't be discouraged by doing that. That's just part of learning this hobby.
That's exactly right.
I have the advantage of, you know, I work in an industry where I work with electric motors and electronics and things like that. But I'll be the first to admit to you, and anyone who's watched my videos knows, I'm a microbiologist.
Mm-hmm.
Model railroading got me the job I have today, believe it or not. People are like, what do you know about electronics? Here, watch this YouTube channel. Tell me if I know anything. But I self-taught. There are plenty of things to learn. YouTube is your friend.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, there are idiots out there. But if you really apply a little common sense, you can figure it out. And ask questions.
Mm-hmm. And the internet forums on Facebook or any place else, you know, groups.io, you know, there's thousands literally of us out there, and everybody's done something at some point.
Well, and you know, Craig, every once in a while I shoot you an email going, does this make sense?
Mm-hmm. And most of the time I say, sure. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and don't forget, you know, the things that came out. I mean, when I was designing this layout, Craig's 10 commandments of building a yard?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, I use that in building my layout.
Okay, and I'm sorry for that, but
it works.
Yeah,
it does. It you know, when you're dealing with operations, sometimes you have to think things a little differently.
Yep,
and
that's
if
true.
You do take on a large layout, here's my other most important thing I learned. The more, the merrier, and the way the layout will finally get built.
Oh, God, yes.
Right.
Do not think that your modeling is so good that you can't accept any help.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll take any help I can get.
That is so true.
I have people that are like, I don't have any modeling skills. I don't care. I can put you to work.
Yeah, I'll find something for you to even gluing popsicle sticks together.
Exactly. And oh, by the way, I've taken people that I'm like, I don't care if you're modeling. I can show you. We can teach you. And
yep.
That's how you get other people involved in this hobby, too, by the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well said.
Good thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming on with us. We definitely look forward to having you on again. Maybe sometime go into a little bit more about making a good diorama. That would make for a pretty excellent show. But we really appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you. And anyone that wants to kind of follow what's going on, I know, Tim, I know you know that any weekend that I'm working on the layout, their photos come up.
That's
they may
right.
be dumb photos, but the photos come on.
And Mike, make sure you plug your YouTube channel because we'd like people to be able to check that out.
So if you go to YouTube, you can just type in my name, Mike Deverell. I come up almost first every time you do that. But if you want to also, you can Google it or go to the Colorado Front Range Railroad.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Nice. And Craig, thank you for being in the co-pilot seat there. Always appreciate
it. As always. No problem. It's good that you caught me when I did, because I'll be back in Canada soon.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow.
All right. Great job, guys. All right.
And, of course, what we open the show with, we close the show with. The Model Railcast theme. Till next time, guys.
You've been listening to the Model Railcast Show. You can find us at www.modelrailcastshow.com or on Facebook at Friends of MRCS and look for us on iTunes. Don't miss your other great model railroading podcasts out there, The Scotty Mason Show, Model Rail Radio, A Modeler's Life, and the Model Railroad Hobbyist Podcast. And drop us a line if we miss mentioning you. This is Amy Perkins for the Model Railcast Show. Have a great week.